So we're going to call to order the meeting of the House Interim Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. It is Wednesday, September 12th. There's a lot of traffic over on Commercial Street, so folks coming down from north of here, maybe including some committee members, may be delayed. I know I just was. But we are going to begin. You can see the times generally on your agenda. We're getting started a few minutes late, but we're going to begin by some significant sections focused on industrial lands and a couple of specific legislative concepts. And so would turn it over to Representative Bentz and his constituent. Welcome to the Transportation Economic Development Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And committee members, Cliff Bentz, District 60, appearing to present a little industrial land proposal. And this morning I'm joined by Dan Joyce, County Judge of Mount Hood County, who drove over rather than go to Washington, D.C., which was an easy decision for him to make. And we're very happy to have him here to answer questions. The purpose of this presentation is to reflect mainly a what I'm going to call a cry for help for our from my little rural towns and communities. What I've noticed over the years I've spent in the Ontario, Nyssa, Vale, Burns, John Day area is that these little communities don't have the money to pay for all of the planning that we now require. And this has resulted in an unfortunate Rip Van Winkle type situation. And Rip Van Winkle, Eastern Oregon, hasn't awakened yet. We're still frozen in time. We don't have the money to escape the rules and regulations we now have in place. And it's really obvious as you drive through the little towns and see that nothing has changed. We need to do something or we're not going to have these little towns. So this morning, I'm going to very rapidly go through this PowerPoint, and then we're going to cut away to Ontario, Nyssa Vale, and listen to some folks there, then to Bend, and then to Gresham. Because this is not just a problem at the level of little rural Oregon, it's a problem across the state. So let's get started. I lifted this quote from the presentation made May 21st to this committee, just to make it clear that if we had more industry, we'd have more jobs. And why isn't this process working? It's simple enough. When you get into this process of land use, it never ends, and you have to keep going and getting money. Ontario is going to try to utilize the expansion of its urban growth boundary and get a little more industrial land, but the cost just for little Ontario, just to get the quote of how much it was going to cost, was $6,000. Doesn't sound like much money, but the city council had to meet, get the $6,000. Then we'll get a quote. We think it's going to be about $100,000 to move that process forward. Can Ontario afford it? Maybe, maybe not. What can we do about this? One thing we could do is tinker with the system, and we have been. Another is fund the current system adequately. I'm not sure where we'd get the money to give to these small towns and these counties. Or three, we could create an exemption allowing industrial development outside the UGB. And this concept has been tendered to LC, and we're waiting on a meeting with them this afternoon. So we'll have this little slideshow. Then we're going to go to these different places. But first of all, I want to establish a sense of place. Most folks don't know Oregon's the ninth largest state. We have 98,000 square miles. We're actually a third bigger than Washington. And we're Oregon's got a third more land, 39% actually, than Washington. Most of Oregon is empty. And one of the reasons is some 52% is owned by the federal government. So much of our land use system is designed to preserve open spaces. We already have a guaranteed 52% open space because most of our state is federal, or at least over half. We have millions of acres of land, though, very little industrial development. There's three major problems. One, our system doesn't adequately anticipate demand. It reacts, and way too slowly. Two, we don't have the money, which I've mentioned. Three, when we finally do get some industrial land, we have so little that buyers are forced to take one parcel and it gets bid up, and some people don't want to sell it. Proof. So let's consider Portland. Again, going back to the presentation on May 21st of this year, we listened to BizOrg, who, by the way, is doing a wonderful job trying to fight their way through the very rules we've created. They divided the metro area into three tiers. And you can see the first tier is 6 months to shovel ready, the second, seven, the third, 2.5 years. and they found 56 sites that fit within those three tiers. And of those 56, 9 were 6 months to shovel ready, 16, 7 months to 2.5 years, and 31, 2.5 years out. And that's for the entire Portland metro area. So the study concluded, not surprisingly, that market choice was limited for large sites when we know, in fact, there's all kinds of demand. Let's consider Far Eastern Oregon, which happens to be part of my district. This is Malheur County, which is just one of the five, 4.5 counties I represent. You can see it is some 9,000 square miles. This slide kind of illustrates the really unfortunate situation. We have 6 million acres in that county. We have 277 that are currently available for industrial use. The largest single parcel within that 277 is 75. That leaves just a mere 6,354,000 acres of space available. Now, the 277, I note it says available. There's about 3,000 in the county available or zoned industrial, but much of it is taken up by the very few industries we already have, and they're not interested in selling. So that which we have available is 277 acres. Let's quickly compare Malheur County to Idaho, right across the river. And I want everyone to notice this. Right across the river, there is 603,000 folks. Boise is 43 miles from our boundary. We're in the same valley. We have 31,000 people, and as you can see, the valley stretching from the border has 600,000 people. So you would think that if we took population into account, we would take that into account in allocating industrial land to Malheur County. That hasn't happened, at least not adequately. This shows you Little Malheur County's growth over the past 110 years. But if you go back, you can see over the last 50, our growth has been anemic. Isn't the right word for it. We haven't had any. And if we go across the river, though, to the three counties right across the river, look at that growth rate. It's almost 4% a year. What the heck? There's a comparison of the growth rate across the river to Malheur County's. That is sad. And it's not just industrial land, but that certainly is a large part of it. So, in an effort to capture kind of how we approach things in Oregon, and this is not to point any fingers at BizOrg, who I think is doing a great job, but I lifted this right out of their certification page, and you can see Oregon is not shovel ready, we're decision ready. What do you think that says to somebody who wants to build in this state? Yeah, you guys are ready to just decide what? Go into another 3 or 4 months of planning. So sadly, our process is compliance, not planning. We need to be shovel ready, not process ready. And we're gonna take a state tour now. We're gonna go to Ontario, then we're gonna go to Bend, then we go to Gresham. The first two are by video, the last one by telephone. So let's go to Ontario. Well, thank you all for being here, and Co-Chair Hunt, it's okay for me to go ahead and...
Please, yeah.
I'm very, very happy. We are joined this morning by four people who prepared for this by sharing with me their thoughts. We're going to start with Larry Wilson, who's over on our left. And Larry, why don't you go ahead and tell us what you have to say.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chairman. I'd like to thank you and your committee first for giving this opportunity to speak with you. I'm Larry Wilson, as you said. I've been a broker and owner of a real estate company in Ontario for the past 35 years.
Hey, Larry. Larry, we can barely hear you. You're going to have to talk a little louder.
Okay. Excuse me. I'll start over. Good morning, Mr. Co-Chairman. I'd like to thank you and your committee for giving us this opportunity to speak with you. I'm Larry Wilson. I've been a broker and owner of a real estate company in Ontario for the past 35 years, and I've served about 12 years on the County Planning Commission. Today, we have an urgent need for more market-ready industrial land. Two phases I will use today we would like to attach a great deal of emphasis on, and that is market-ready and in a timely manner. We have over 6 million acres of land in Malheur County, and very little of it can be used for industrial use. The Ontario, Nyssa, and Vail communities are ideally situated as a transportation center. We are located on I-84 and several major highways, and we also have rail and air service. We are a perfect location for data and distribution centers, agricultural processors, as well as other businesses. However, the largest parcel of industrially zoned land in Ontario is 75 acres with only 54 usable acres. NISA has a 26-acre parcel in their urban growth boundary, while Vail has no parcels of any relative size that are available. We have had 6 data centers, 2 distribution warehouses, 2 food processors, a modular manufacturer, 1 alternative energy manufacturer, and a fertilizer plant. Interested in our area just since 2005. Conservatively, they would have employed about 2,290 people. All these companies have gone elsewhere. That is a lot of opportunity lost. They all needed larger parcels, more choices and locations to consider, and the ability to be market ready in a timely manner. This is why we're asking for your help. We have no flexibility or local control in helping businesses find a suitable parcel in the location they desire or a parcel size suitable for their needs so they can get a business started in a timely manner. We are light years behind our neighbors in Idaho in all aspects of attracting businesses. They are booming and we are stagnant at best. For years, our land use laws have been growth and population driven, not demand driven. Under our current land use restrictions, we simply cannot meet the requirements of prospective businesses in a timely manner. Thank you for hearing this presentation.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
Mr. Co-Chair and committee members, thank you for this opportunity and good morning. My name is Kit Kommel. I am the Executive Director for the Snake River Economic Development Alliance. I'm responsible for recruiting new business and living wage jobs to Malheur County and 2 counties in Idaho. On an average of once a week, we get a request for manufacturing or industrial sites in this area. Let me share some examples of the problems I face in Oregon. Within this last month, we received a request for 75 acres for a distribution center, requiring railroad access. Malheur County has rail in Ontario, Vail, and NISA, but no appropriately zoned land. Recently, another request for 80 acres for a distribution center next to the freeway. Ontario has the freeway plus excellent access to and from, but no appropriately zoned land. Currently, we have a pending request for 100 acres for a data center requiring access to power. NISA and Ontario are a perfect fit, but no appropriately zoned land. In the past, we've had businesses that did not choose Malheur County and located in Idaho. The lack of appropriately zoned land greatly contributed to their location decisions. Some examples are Dickinson Frozen Foods, Fry Foods, Coca-Cola Bottling, and ADM Edible Bean Specialties. Millions of dollars and hundreds of jobs lost to Idaho. We have had businesses in Malheur County that needed to grow and expand, but no appropriately zoned land. Examples of these lost opportunities are Fort Boise Produce, Partner Produce, American Fine Foods, McCain Foods, and Amalgamated Sugar. They left Malheur County, moved to Idaho, where they invested millions of dollars and created hundreds of jobs. Why is it in Malheur County that millions of acres of land, only one very large parcel is available? And the process to get another site zoned and shovel ready takes years and costs tens of thousands of dollars. Idaho's zoning process, including the public hearings, takes 30 to 60 days. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Reed Saito. I am a third-generation farmer in NISA, Oregon, and I am the past chairman of the Oregon State Board of Agriculture. During 8 years of serving on the Board of Ag, I saw that our farms in Oregon and locally can produce a great variety of crops, but we need local value-added businesses in order to gain the benefits of producing those crops. A major roadblock to new businesses locating in Malheur County are the current land use regulations. We have no shortage of land here. What we do have is an overly stringent land use regulations. regulations that may work well in other parts of Oregon, but only hamper our efforts here to bring in new businesses. Companies like Reeser Foods, Fry Foods, Amalgamated Sugar, and Archer Daniel Midland have chosen other states partly due to the lack of available buildable land to meet their needs. Other successful local companies, packers and processors, choose not to expand here, but rather find it easier to move across state lines. In effect, we are exporting our value-added opportunities to Idaho and Washington. That is our current situation here. Now we are asking the legislature to please take action to allow more industrial land in Oregon. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Reed.
Thank you.
We're going to hear now from drove over from Burns this morning to be in Ontario, the two and a half hour drive to share with us Burns' experience in trying to get land streamlined under our credentialing process. Don, go ahead.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I am Don Munkers. I'm the manager for the City of Burns. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this hearing to discuss a process that was established some 30 years ago. The process in the beginning was based on admirable intentions. However, in today's extremely competitive world, changes are needed in order to provide Oregon, and especially its small communities, the edge needed to compete. The City of Burns recently discovered just how broke the process is. We started rezoning in industrial land in 2007. We knew that we did not have enough non-constrained lands in Burns, and so an original 100 acres was designated above the floodplain. After approximately 180 days of meetings, several drafts, reviews, and redrafts at an estimated cost of $15,000 to $20,000, the City Council passed in 2010 the land use zoning for that industrial site. Having completed that maze of the process, the next challenge was an attempt to secure the state certification for those industrial lands. The process for this certification was frustrating at best. 3 to 4 conference calls between the city, its engineer, and the state, and we still did not have a comfortable position on what was needed. The one issue that kept coming up was that the city was going to have to guarantee any potential tenant that within 6 months, water, sewer, road access, and power would be available to that site. Members of the committee, the bidding laws that govern small municipalities would prevent the ability to make that guarantee unless the city put the utilities in prior to the agreement with the tenant. That is just the reverse of reality. Negotiations with the tenant helps offset the cost of installing those infrastructure needs. The city is in no position to spend $250,000 plus to install those infrastructures and then set back and hope for a tenant. The city finally established a scope of work for the industrial site certification that consisted of 13 tasks, estimated at about $99,400. It was going to cost the city, therefore, over $10,000 in match money just to secure state assistance. The city does not have this money, hence no certification, meaning that the state will not assist in marketing the site. Members of the committee, the process is flawed. We appear to be our own worst enemy, and Oregon's small cities cannot compete with neighboring states. We cannot get 40 acres certified as shovel-ready, but other states seem to be able to have the whole state shovel-ready. The process needs review and change to get into the 21st century. Again, I thank you for the opportunity. I applaud your willingness to investigate this tough issue for the state and for the small communities that find it so difficult to be competitive. Without that competitive edge, these small communities have the real potential to shrivel and die on the vine.
Thank you, Don. And Mr. Chair, I think because of our time constraints, we probably should move on to our next hearing in Bend. I just want to thank every one of you for coming to the meeting here in Ontario, and thank you for your testimony today.
Yeah, we very much appreciate your participating with us and focusing a spotlight on this important issue. Thanks so much.
And with that, if we could move to Bend.
So whatever we need to do technologically to make that switch. So I think we're going to, in fact, if we could pull the lights up while we're doing that, well, we've got a couple intervening minutes here while the technology changes. If members of the committee do have any questions for Representative Bentz or Judge Joyce, this would be an appropriate time to ask questions. Representative Lindsay.
Not a question, but thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, but just a statement. That's great to see that many people come out and participate. I'm sorry, but I don't see that many numbers of people come out, and that's very honorable.
If I may, this is a huge deal. There were three cities there, four actually. Nissa was represented, Vail was represented, Ontario was represented, and of course, Mr. Munkers drove over from Burns. This is a great big deal. If we don't, we have all these businesses moving 100 feet across into Idaho. And it's really sad. Some of them, they're leaving Oregon. The Bayer Aspirin Corporation bought up a small local business called Noonan's out of Nissa, which is right on the border, and it moved a quarter of a mile into Idaho. It now employs something like 200 people on the Idaho side, and it's a wonderful, clean industry. We lost it. We didn't have the land. They wanted to expand in our state. They didn't. And so it's a worldwide export market for seed. One other thing I want to mention, the limiting factor in eastern Oregon for growth is water. It's not land. And this thought that we would take up valuable farmland for industry is incorrect, because when we put industry in place, we then move the water to part of the desert that's been dry. So we have thousands of acres available to farm. We just don't have the water. Thank you. With that, Mr. Chair, I think we can go to, I think we're going to Bend. And we are joined by four people. And we had a little bit of a change in the folks that were going to testify. So let's just start with the person over on you guys' right. And introduce yourself and go ahead.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Roger Lee. I'm the Executive Director for Economic Development for Central Oregon, an organization that serves the Tri-County area of Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson. And my comments will focus on specific examples where Oregon has lost opportunities, and then my colleagues talk more about policy issues. Over the past decade, Bend has been eliminated from consideration for numerous companies, including a call center, 900 jobs, a cutlery manufacturing plant, 300 jobs, and a high technology company, 400 jobs, among others, just because of the lack of either of available industrial property or the high cost precipitated by a constrained supply. It's the fastest, you know, during that time, the number of Bend companies that have moved elsewhere in the Central Oregon region where industrial land does supply is there's a number of those. You know, combined, these companies represent hundreds of jobs. Despite efforts over the past six-plus years, the city of Bend has been unsuccessful in getting state approval to expand its UGB, including industrial and other employment lands. As the fastest-growing metropolitan in Oregon over the last two decades, such an outcome should be completely unacceptable to both legislative and executive branches. In Redmond, expected delays from a required zone change on portions of a large parcel inside the urban growth boundary and city limits killed interest from a company that we were working with that was looking to invest $200 to $300 million initially and create 50 well-paying jobs. When we explained the optimistic time frame to get a zone change would be 6 months, one of the principals said, where I come from, that would take 3 weeks. He was from the Carolinas. The situation is in the process of being resolved thanks to the passage of SB 1544, but even that process will take more than a year to actually work through. Communities are being left with legislative solutions as their only option to these land use problems. In Jefferson County, where all incorporated communities are bordered by high-value farmland, industrial zone property inventories have not expanded in 20 years, resulting in severe shortage of fee-simple land for available for sale. Earlier this year, Madras lost an industrial prospect because of this constraint, costing this economically distressed county dozens of family wage jobs. Oregon has a considerable and sophisticated competition in the race for jobs. We need to do everything possible not to eliminate ourselves from the running. Thank you.
Thank you. And go ahead.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. My name is George Endicott. I'm the mayor of Redmond. I was a councilor before that and on the Planning Commission before that, so I've got kind of a long history of watching events in Redmond and Central Oregon. I'm going to take a little bit further of that example that Mr. Lee talked about, and that's the 465 acres of land in Redmond. It was originally zoned industrial. We changed it at a request of the county to open space to build the fairgrounds. They moved to a different site. We went to move it back to industrial and told no. The transportation planning rule had kicked in, and we were not allowed to take land that had once been industrially zoned and move it back to industrial. As a consequence, you heard from Mr. Lee that we lost an opportunity for someone that wanted to take that land and develop about 200 acres of it. As a consequence, Senators Beyer and Telfer supported an effort to get Senate Bill 1544 passed last legislative session, which actually called for a streamlined process to zone that land back to industrial. It's going to take us approximately 12 months, and that's with us pushing the deadline very hard all the time. That's by our local officials and our local government employees. And it will result in us investing significant resources of consultant and staff time into this process. And that's after a state law was passed that said to do it. So the point I'm making here is that there has to be a way to improve this process. One is to think about local control or decision-making at our level vis-a-vis the state level. I would propose that is one thing to think about in this whole effort. And then the other one, as we know, the transportation planning rule has been modified, but it still probably isn't generous enough as it needs to be to allow land to be rezoned. And the final point I'll make is, so far, and you heard earlier, and I think you might hear again, is that all of our land use decisions are population driven, and certainly for industrial lands, we should seriously consider demand driven. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Other Mr. Mayor?
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Eager. I'm the mayor of the city of Bend. And I'm going to echo a couple of the things that the previous speakers on this panel have mentioned, but to add a little bit more Bend-specific twist to it, I think that the debate regarding industrial lands and land use in general in Oregon tends to relate to employment versus livability. And I can tell you that for Bend and the rest of Deschutes County, which has had an unemployment rate of 11% or more for the last several years, the primary livability challenge that we have is a lack of good jobs here. And one of the reasons why we have a lack of good jobs is because of the state's antiquated land use policies as it pertains to large lot industrial lands. The city of Bend has only a handful of parcels over 10 acres in size and has about four that are between the 10 to 20 acres. You compare this to some of the large lot industrial activity that occurs, or demand that may occur. I think Apple has obtained over 100 acres over in Prineville, which is very good for Prineville, and we're all very excited about that for the region. But the point is that Bend does not have large lots to accommodate the types of users that Mr. Lee mentioned and other potential businesses out there that would employ people here. The system, in my opinion, needs to be reformed. The city of Bend has submitted a urban growth boundary expansion to the state of Oregon about 4 years ago, and that is still in process. That UGB expansion would have brought a couple of 50-acre industrial lots into the UGB, but obviously, based on Bend's experience, the system takes too long, and it is far too costly for a city like Bend to complete in a timely manner. That system needs to be changed so that, as Mayor Endicott mentioned, there is local control over how industrial lands come in, and local control that reacts to market or demand forces, so that we are putting the types of land online locally that we know, thanks to the assistance of professionals like Mr. Lee, is in demand for the types of companies that want to move to Central Oregon. And again, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee, I thank you for your time and your attention to this important issue.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, and all those that joined the folks in testifying this morning. And I wish we had more time for questions, but I know we have a huge agenda. So just thank you so much for coming in and sharing with us this morning. And with that, we are going to go to Gresham, which I understand we are going to do by telephone.
Old school.
Apparently, they don't have television in Gresham yet.
Ouch.
Hi, this is Patrick Brennan with the Committee Services Office at the Oregon Legislature. We are ready for a conference call with the mayor.
I will transfer you. Hold on, please.
Can I ask one question while we're waiting for them? You had mentioned, I think in Malheur County, 277 acres currently zoned industrial. Can you give us a sense of what the ownership of that right now? I mean, is it spread into a whole bunch of different ownership, or is it more centralized?
Right. The largest parcel is about 75 acres under one ownership, and it's immediately adjacent to our new Beltline. And that parcel is the only large parcel that fits many people's requirements. The rest of them are much smaller and scattered. So it's unfortunate. So those that we do have are in the wrong place, and the ones that we would like to have alongside our brand new Beltway aren't there yet. And so the process of, it's crazy, and forgive my frustration, but we put in with the state's help a very large 2 or 3 mile stretch of road that circles Ontario, leaving all kinds of land on each side available, but not correctly zoned. And so the process of moving in that direction is going to cost literally $100,000, maybe, to get just the zoning changed. We would much rather be spending that money on sewer extensions and roads. But the short answer is, of the 75 acres in one parcel of that 255, and only about 55 of that 75 is actually usable. The rest is down in a draw.
Okay. Do we have anybody on the phone with us? I thought so, Mr. Chair. Sorry about that. We will try again.
Judge Joyce, anything you want to add based on what you've heard or observed so far?
Mr. Chairman and co-chairs and committee, I think that...
if you could just introduce yourself for the
record. Dan Joyce, County Judge from Vail, Oregon. But I think it's pretty well covered here, and I want to thank Representative Benz. But the one thing that I thought about as we go through this process, my son lives and works in Texas. He'd love to be home.
I should mention the little town of...
There?
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm.
Hold on, please.
The little town of Burns is a classic example of not having the money necessary to try to do all the process, to try to bring the 40 acres in, to try to bring the business in. It's really sad. And what's even sadder is our telephone.
Hello, this is Patrick Brennan with the Oregon Legislature. Do we have somebody on the phone with us?
Yes, you do. Hey, we're here in Gresham.
Welcome to the committee. We can hear you very well, so if all three of you are there, you can proceed in whatever order you want. If you could just introduce yourself for the record.
We will. This is Travis Stovall with East Metro Economic Alliance Executive Director. Good morning, co-chair and committee. We are on the phone today here from Gresham discussing the availability of industrial lands and everything. Many of the things that have already been presented by the groups there in Bend and there in Ontario are critical key issues across the state. We've got Mayor Shane Bemis here with us this morning, and then also Kathy Clevenger, Vice President of Operations for Microchip, who are going to give some perspectives about some of the challenges that we're currently facing here in the metro region, specifically here in the East Metro. What I wanted to do is highlight a fresh example of the challenges that we're facing in regards to the availability of industrial lands. Just last evening, a business here in the East Metro area actually called me with critical concern of having industrial lands available to expand their business. When they called, they said, Travis, we've been looking for months and we are challenged to expand our business here in the region because we can't find available heavy industrial lands. As a matter of fact, there are only a couple of key sites that we can expand into, and the price of those sites are actually a little bit out of reach based on the limited availability of those lands. At one point, they mentioned that they actually looked across the river in Clark County at siting their business so that they could expand and create jobs here in our region. They went through a couple of items, kind of a laundry list of the key things that they see were the challenges that stand in the way of that opportunity, but it all came down to the critical limited availability of the industrial lands, specifically industrial lands, available here in the metro region. But then you've also got to look at it from a state perspective. And so while you've heard many of the other presenters talk about the number of jobs and that have gone out of the state, also looking at the situation that we're faced with here, and that is the idea that we've got expansion opportunities and then also companies that can move here to the area. The other two presenters this morning are actually going to touch on some other key critical parts of the challenges that we face on a day-to-day basis in recruiting and expanding businesses in our community. Next up will be Kathy Clevenger.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chairman. Again, I'm Kathy Clevenger, Vice President of Operations at Microchip Technology and also current President of East Metro Economic Alliance, an advocacy organization out in East Metro area of Multnomah County. So as Travis was saying, in Portland area, we have a limited supply of industrial land that is currently shovel-ready or ready to develop within 180 days. In that group, there's only one site that's over 50 acres and another site that's over 100 acres that's shovel-ready. The 100-acre site is out here in Gresham, in the Gresham Vista Business Park, which is now owned by the Port of Portland. To attract companies to the area, we really need to have more availability of industrial land so that they have options. They need options because there are many other factors that a company is going to look at, including the land proximity to the workforce that they need, proximity to suppliers, to customers, or the ability to ship from there. There's also potentially limitations in individual properties, the topography of the land or the shape that could affect the cost of building whatever they need to build, and other things like wetlands issues that may exist that limit their ability to use the land, even the neighbors. And so not having multiple options for a company that may be considering this area makes it less attractive, especially for a company that has options not only in the region but across the country or worldwide where they could potentially locate. In addition, having a limited supply could increase the cost, which is obviously going to be a key issue for companies that are considering relocation. I'm going to turn it over to Mayor Bemis.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to chat with you a little bit this morning. I'm not going to touch on a lot of the issues that have already been raised. Well, I think there are valid issues in terms of industrial land supply and some of the issues facing broadly the state in terms of economic development. I think you heard and already know a lot about that. I did want to raise something that is sort of obscure, and it's the sort of the urban-rural strategic investment zone issue, and really just very briefly, and we can dive into it offline a little bit, but in terms of the strategic investment zone, we believe that rural designations should really be in rural parts of the state. For instance, the city of Hillsboro, much of all of their new industrial land after December of 2002 is in a rural designation, which means that their strategic investment zone, the investment is capped at $25 million, whereas Gresham, in a urban setting, the same as Hillsboro, we are under the urban setting, which is $100 million in terms of taxes. So we think that that is an inequity. We think that places like Hillsborough that are urban or should be designated urban. And we also think that the rural, you know, the intention of this to help rural areas, they should not be competing with Hillsborough. They should be competing with other rural areas, which I think is the intent, not from some arbitrary date in 2002 when these lands were added. Again, it's a complex issue. We raised it a little bit last year in the legislature, and we will, you know, probably be trying to pursue some sort of remedy to that from the city's perspective again in the next session. But thank you for the opportunity to chat with you this morning, and thank you for all the work you're doing.
Thank you. We appreciate all three of you testifying before us. Representative Bentz, any closing comments for this segment?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Only that we will be bringing a bill for everyone to consider, and today's purpose was to raise the awareness level of the challenge we face, and we can do something about it. We just need to do some really hard work, and I'm looking forward to working with Co-Vice Chair Reed on, we've talked about it, and others, to try to work through this. It's kind of a matter of economic life for my communities, and I'm sure others. So thank you very much for your consideration.
Yeah, thank you very much. And you can see on this first segment, we've erred on the side of having lots of witnesses fill the time, fewer questions. We're now moving into a segment where we have fewer witnesses, more opportunity for questions. Very much appreciate you you all being here and everyone testifying. And Representative Reed, you can have whoever you want. Who do you want to join you for this first? You want Tom and Bernie, or who do you want?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very quick, so
okay.
I'll just make a couple comments. And
sounds good.
They can follow. They're well coordinated and choreographed at this point, I'm sure. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Tobias Reed, state representative from District 27 in Beaverton, and I think you, it's probably clear to all of you, based on the conversation we've already had today, that this issue really resonates throughout the state. There are likely different versions of the story depending on the district and the circumstances that our communities confront, but it is a consistent theme across the state. And Representative Benson and I have, I think, both taken on the issue to a certain extent from different perspectives, certainly from different locations, but we're coming with a lot of the same concerns. And for me, it really harkens back to the presentation that we heard at one of our previous committee meetings from about the study that was undertaken by the Port, the Portland Business Alliance, and Business Oregon, and that really highlighted a lot of the particulars. I think it did a good job of identifying some of the issues, and so what is exciting is thinking about what the next steps are. We really have, I think, an important opportunity upcoming in the next session because of the level of interest, because of the capacity we have to come together and identify some solutions that that can work. I've been part of some conversations that have been ongoing with the, and really want to thank and acknowledge the role that the Port, the Thousand Friends of Oregon, the Portland Business Alliance, the Governor's Office, and the agencies and others have taken in leading those conversations and exploring some possibilities and some concepts that might come before us in the next legislature. So that's really my role, is to just to introduce those folks and let them explain and give you a little update on some of the concepts we've been discussing. I do think we have a real chance to craft something that can be faithful to Oregon's traditions of planning and balance, and really unleash the economic growth that we all need and want. So rather than reading the list of people who are on your agenda, I will simply step aside and let those folks explain what we've been talking about. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you. So it's been suggested we might bring President Hughes up by himself first, and then the other three all as one panel. But if you have another preference, okay. I'm getting a thumbs up and nodding heads.
And that's always good, Mr. Co-Chair.
Good. People always want the president to go by himself.
I know. It's a strange phenomenon that I'm just barely getting used to. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity today to come before you to talk about the issue of industrial lands. And I was taken, struck
Tom,
by...
Can you just introduce yourself?
Oh, sorry. I'm Tom Hughes. I'm currently president of the Metro Council. I was taken, struck by the similarities between what we're likely to say to you today and what was said by the folks from around the state. It's a slightly different problem, I think, from our perspective in Portland, but it boils down to the same thing, and that is that if we turn the economy around, and I think you heard folks around the state saying it doesn't have to turn around much because they're getting inquiries even now for sites that they don't have, we would have a similar problem in the Portland metropolitan area. We have taken the step, along with our partners at PBA and Port of Portland, to do an industrial land survey. And what that industrial land survey tells us is that if we were looking at land that would be available for development in the next 6 months, if a company came to us today and said we need to look at sites where we can be up and running in the next start construction in the next 6 months, we would have 9 sites in the Portland metropolitan area to show them. And the reason that that's not enough is that each of those sites that is not further constrained and doesn't present much time delay, has its own configuration and its own set of issues. And so if none of those met the needs of the company that was coming, the company would simply have to look elsewhere. I want to emphasize that this is really not yet a discussion about urban growth boundary or not urban growth boundary in the Portland metro area, because the inventory that we did indicates that there are over 50 sites in the Portland metropolitan area that could be available, but each of those additional sites have a number of constraints that prevent them from being available within the next 6 months. And they fall into a bunch of different categories. Some of those issues relate to the ownership. They're not in single ownership. Multiple ownerships create problems for assembly. We lost over the years probably the best tool that we had for assembling land on the public side, which was the power of condemnation, or in most cases, in my experience, the threat of condemnation, allowed us to be able to purchase land from owners who had unrealistic expectations of what it meant to sell their land for industrial uses, and we were able to do that in places in Hillsborough, in places like Rondler Acres, in particular, was probably one of the best urban renewal development projects in the history of the state, which is the location of the current Intel campus. Those kinds of opportunities are no longer there. So wherever there are multiple ownerships, that creates problems. There is no good mechanism for pulling those owners together, keeping them on, keeping their feet to the fire, holding them to a willing seller agreement, for example. Again, in Hillsborough, we managed that for Genentech. We failed to manage that for the property just north of Genentech and blew off about $1.5 billion investment because one of the owners decided at the last minute that their willing seller agreement was not satisfactory and they needed additional money for their land. Those kinds of problems exist on a number of the lots that we're looking at. Others of those lots have transportation or other infrastructure issues. Question of delivering water, the question of delivering wastewater treatment, and by and large, I think one of the bigger issues in the area, of course, is transportation. And then the third level are those that have some level of contamination as a result of past uses on the property, and they range all the way from lots that had previously had a cleaners or a dry cleaning facility or a service station on the site to some of the parcels in the northwest industrial area that are part of the Superfund sites that have pretty significant contamination. If you arrange those, you can arrange those sites in a number of different ways. The way I like to look at it is in terms of the time to market. So if we went today, if we had a prospect today, and by the way, as Vice Chair of Greater Portland, Inc., I can also tell you that there are, in fact, about 27 prospects lurking around the Portland area at the moment in the pipeline up there. If we had to take one of those prospects out today and say, here's a parcel of land, it'll be available to you as soon as we, first of all, clean up the contamination, and second of all, get it certified by the federal government that it's acceptable for your use. They would probably smile and go someplace else. We've had the experience, again, I rely a little bit on my experience as having been 8 years as the mayor of Hillsborough, during which time we cited a number of companies, and I think we had almost every one of the issues that the folks who testified on Representative Bence's program a little bit earlier, we had virtually every one of those issues in Hillsborough also, and managed to struggle through because we had a synergy of companies that were already there that attracted additional companies. So that was a help for us, and we had a very very professional staff that knew how to do that. Here's where I think the state can be of some assistance, and this is, I think, the reason we're before you today. Even cities in the metro area, even large cities in the metro area, have difficulty in two areas: investing the money for due diligence. So we've got these 50 sites identified. We're in the process, we being Metro, are in the process right now of trying to analyze those sites and say, at some level, what needs to be done in order for this site to be shovel-ready. The reality, though, is that the local governments really need to go in and do due diligence, determine what kinds of constraints are there, what needs to be done to remove the constraints. And then, of course, there's the site preparation, which is really the expensive part of it. Whether it's identifying and mitigating or protecting wetlands, whether it's identifying availability of wastewater or water facilities, whether it's planning for the transportation system, or whether it's abating brownfield contamination, all of those have their own costs and their own times involved. We think that there is a good case can be made for a partnership between local governments and the state to help with those two phases of bringing some of those sites. And again, I think it applies to whether we're talking about the sites in the greater Portland metropolitan area or the sites in Ontario or Nyssa or Burns or anywhere else in the state, that those local governments have the same kinds of issues that our governments have in terms of finding the funding to do that. We think there's an opportunity for the state to look at a program where the state would create a loan program where they could loan the local governments the money to do those two original sites. Part of that loan could be forgiven if a site was selected by a company and if jobs were created. The theory being that when you create jobs, those jobs are that they help with the livability factor in the community, but financially the benefit derives to the state through increased income tax, and that the state as the beneficiary could assist with the local governments and even share maybe in some of that cost, but only if that investment leads to job creation, which is the way the structure of what we're proposing is set up. I think that you all know, I know, the value of traded sector manufacturing jobs. Those are the jobs where we do something in Oregon and sell that product to somebody else. That brings money into the state. It pays workers in the state. They pay state taxes, and everybody is happy. Those jobs in particular require land as the number one requirement for where they can go. We think that we can make a dent in some of that need if the state will partner with us as local government, and the suggestion that we're making, I think, is a fair and reasonable one. So I'd be happy to answer any questions about any of the land issues related to the Portland metropolitan area, as well as and there will be others who will talk more about our proposal. So.
Thank you. Yeah, we do have time for a couple questions. Questions for President Hughes. Co-Chair Brents.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you for your thinking on this. I went online this morning and read a number of the articles about recent attempts to extend the UGB for areas around Portland, and noticed that there was a recent vote not to allow that to happen, even though there was industry that was willing to come should that have occurred. And there were the balancing appeared to be, we don't have the money for the roads, we don't have the money for the sewer, we don't have the money, therefore we're not going to let you expand. And then the second argument seemed to be, we don't want to expand the space and allow more residences, which would add to or allow housing and other things outside the urban growth boundary. Just to draw a comparison between that and, let's say, Ontario and Nissa Vale, most of the residence happens in Idaho, and people drive into Oregon to work. That would be the prison SRCI, so we have 1,000 jobs up there. Two-thirds of the people live in Idaho. Mm. So we're not constrained by that unfortunate limitation that apparently binds up the Portland area. Yet our rules appear to be the same. So now I forgot how you voted on that particular issue. It was two voted for it and a number voted against it, and somebody was missing from the vote. And I'm just curious, if the residential issue was not in play and it was only industrial, do you think the outcome of that vote would have been different?
Co-Chair Hunt and Co-Chair Benz, we tend to look at, for the most part, at industrial expansion and residential expansion as two separate but somewhat joined issues. And so the issue of expanding for industrial land really has boiled down the discussion, and while I am new to Metro, I'm not new to the discussion about expanding for industrial land, because it was high on our agenda when I was mayor of Hillsborough, and we have had some expansion out in Hillsborough. I think that for the most part the debate was about the land itself. The difficulty that we have, as somebody highlighted, I think, in Ontario and Bend, the difficulty we had on the west side of Portland, Hillsborough, Beaverton, Forest Grove, is that we have land that would be good for industrial development. It is, unfortunately or unfortunately, also extremely good for farmland. And so We have addressed that issue a little bit in the urban reserve, rural reserve concept, which we just used for our last urban growth boundary expansion, but the balancing of the farm needs with the industrial needs has been where most of the discussion has gone, rather than the discussion about needing additional housing.
Follow up. Thank you. In reviewing the newspaper article, I think it was 1,200 acres, 300 of which was going to be used for industrial and the rest for residential. And there was some reference in passing at the end of the article. Someone mentioned the loss of rich farmland, obviously that phrase. And it strikes me that years ago, in 1973, when this law was passed, there were two types of industry that were preserved and protected, farming and logging, timber. Those lands were protected, yet industry was not. Seems odd. And it seems to me that industry, given the jobs and the need for our general fund, the industry should be placed back on that list as one of those protected areas that rises at least to the level of farmland. And so tell me what you think the future of that debate would be, given that quick resort to this rich farmland mantra that we hear every time we talk about this issue.
Representative Hunt, Representative Bent, it is a balancing act that we're engaged in, and it is how do you balance those two needs. I quite frankly believe, and I did vote in favor of the urban growth boundary expansion that we just passed, and you have assessed it correctly, was 1,200 acres, of a little over 300 of which is industrial land, because I felt that did strike the balance. I mean, it did. We have a significant amount of rich farmland left available in the Portland metropolitan area, and that in the urban reserve, rural reserve discussion, for example, we brought 28,000 acres of land into the urban reserve, which is the urban supply of land for the next 50 years, and preserved about 270,000 acres of farmland. So I think that that's, I don't know how you could look at that and not say that's a fair balance on the side of agriculture. Quite frankly, I think that what the land use laws allow right now, as we look at it, I wouldn't have said this probably in 06 or 07, but right now I would say that it allows a fair metering of the land coming in. It's coming in terms of the land we're bringing in, it's coming in just about as fast as we're able to accommodate it. In terms of, but as the economy turns around, that will no longer be true. It wasn't true in 07, for example, when we had seven companies seriously looking at three sites in Hillsboro that they wanted, each of them with an industrial development, and clearly, had the economy stayed where it was, four of those companies would have gone someplace else, probably to another state or another country. I would have liked to have been able to have accommodated all seven of those companies. And again, I think that the secret is a combination of small expansion of the urban growth boundary that provide land that still requires some time, but we're looking at 1 to 2 to 3 years, depending on the legal ramifications of it, and it'll be ready, as opposed to Brownfield, for example. And if you look at the ports site out at Troutdale, I think that's a cautionary note. They bought the land when Alcoa had invested a substantial amount of money in cleaning this site, so they got the site relatively clean, but from the day they got the site until the day they were able to put it on the market, it took 5 years to go through the federal certification process. So if, again, as you put brownfields on the list of things that we need to make available in order order to have an adequate land supply, you've got to appropriately time, figure how much time to allow for that land to be available. And brownfields in particular are going to be long and expensive, not just because of the cleanup, which takes a while, but also because of the federal certification project on some of those properties. So I think that you need to look at the whole spectrum of land that's available and figure out ways to create new sites within all of those categories over that time span.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Good to see you, Tom. Have you seen or heard or thought of smart financing strategies that are sort of fiscally prudent and include a reasonable return to taxpayers? So part of the discussion, and it's going to be the challenging part of the discussion, is how much we should eviscerate land use regulations and let whatever happens. Another piece is, with the sites we have or sites that are expanded, how do we make them ready so that somebody wants to use them? And I don't know if it's, tax increment financing with clawbacks, have we thought of smart investment strategies that aren't just raiding the public fisc, but that do put us in a sort of more competitive position?
Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Smith, quite frankly, in my experience in doing this for a while now, the mechanism that you're referring to, I think the best mechanism that you're referring to is urban renewal. Urban renewal works differently in different places, and it works differently for different purposes. But as we've applied it as out in Hillsborough, I think it did exactly what you were talking about. The Rondler Acres Urban Renewal Site is an example. We froze $8 million on the tax rolls. We did $36 million worth of public improvements, and 9.5 years later rolled $640 million back onto the tax roll. That investment paid a dividend for every one of those public entities that froze their tax rate in order to create the TIF. They don't all work that well, is part of the problem. And I think that where we're looking at industrial sites in particular, there's some difficulty. Brownfield development, for example, creates a particular problem in that quite frequently the cost of mitigating the brownfield exceeds the cost, the value that you're ever going to get out of the property. So if you're converting industrial to industrial with a brownfield mitigation, that's a very difficult proposition. Well, what we've seen, I think, in Portland and other places is good conversion of brownfield to mixed use or brownfield to residential, where you're adding a value to the land that you don't get with just the industrial. So it doesn't always work that well when you're talking about brownfield mitigation, but in order to provide the financing for some of the other things that you're that are constraints, infrastructure needs, transportation, wastewater, water facilities, even I suspect as we begin to look more seriously at broadband and some of the more modern infrastructure needs, urban renewal, quite frankly, has worked really very, very well with those limitations.
Yeah. Mr. Felton,
sure. I'm hoping we'll see the sort of whole picture here and look for to use your word, a balance, and not only between farmland, forest land, industrial land, and residential land, but between some of the tensions. I think that we need to get to the hard part before we rush headlong and the head part hits us in the back of the head. For instance, let's say this testimony today is really successful, and we get unanimous support here and get it across the floor to make significant changes in the ease of expanding boundaries and expanding uses of industrial land. A challenge I see is that will then make available industrial land cheaper by making available industrial land cheaper, just with greater demand, or greater supply.
Right.
That will make it harder to have the incentive to improve the lots we have. And I haven't yet heard anybody sort of testify to that. I mean, I'm hoping that we will do what we can to improve the industrial lands that we have, the sites we have, and maximize the use thereof, and also recognize not all industrial uses are equal, right? Both in terms of costs going forward, in terms of benefits in the near and intermediate terms. So I hope we're thinking about that. I mean, I share the need for figuring out how we can best make available industrial lands, but I want to make sure we're not just sort of spoiling one place, going to another, spoiling that one, and then going to another one, all the way making the price cheaper and cheaper.
Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Smith, I agree, and I think the other balance that we need to strike is the balance between the local share of that effort and the state share of that effort. And that's,
I want the state to pay for it now. I mean, I think.
Yeah.
I used to think that was a municipal thing, but I now think that's a state thing.
But you're right. The thing that I think we have to that we can't lose sight of in all of our discussion about how to change and adjust the system that we've got, we were doing a recruitment in 06, I think it was. The governor had been down the Bay Area and recruited Genentech a lot, and we were working on it a lot. And finally, they decided that they would locate in a site in Hillsborough. We knew at the time we were doing that our competition was Dallas. And what we heard on the street was that the Dallas offer was about $50 million better than the Hillsborough offer. Yet they came to Hillsborough. Mm-hmm. And somebody, I think it was somebody in a committee when I was talking about that, said I'd pay $50 million not to have to go to Dallas, too. and I think that there is truth to that, maintaining the quality of life is, and I agree with the statement that says a good job is where a quality of life starts, but we will be more successful recruiting those companies that provide those kinds of jobs to the degree that we pay attention to the quality of life and the quality of life that we have created by the application of a somewhat mystical, somewhat magical, and sometimes dang frustrating land use planning system that we've got. So, I think the balance, we got to strike that balance between how do we ratchet those costs down to the point that they don't drive us out of business. The other thing, though, that you got to keep in mind is that you're right in that keeping the cost of industrial land up helps do brownfield mitigation and other, but it also makes us less competitive with places like Dallas and places where they don't worry about that.
Thanks, Tom. Karen.
Last question, then we'll move on to the next panel. Representative Lindsay.
I agree that was an important factor of the industrial. I think that was secondary, though. If we had asked Genentech, they would say the number one was single sales factor, right?
Yep. Absolutely. Look, Co-Chair Hunt and Representative Lindsay, when they make the list, their list is kind of intriguing, and I've heard their vice president do it a couple of times. One, and single sales factor was number one on their list. Number two was the quality of life. Number three was the ease of handling the traffic on 26, which we all kind of chuckle about. But I guess if what you're used to is the Bayshore Freeway, then 26 looks pretty good. There is no single factor that brings a company to your location. We know that if they can't find available land, they aren't going to come. That's pretty much of a given. Our tax structure, for all of our kind of flopping around about it, is actually at the corporate level very attractive to companies, the single sales factor in particular, and quality of life, which attracts the workers that they want to hire, is really a key to having them come too. All of those things have to be in balance in order to do a successful recruitment.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Your testimony in council, and we'll invite forward Bernie, Steve, and Ray. Welcome. Welcome back.
Let me switch seats with you since I'll do the...
Bernie, are you going to talk to us about Malheur County? I know what you're going to slide up there for.
I hesitate to do that. I've been to Stitch Mountain, but that's about all I know. Co-chairs Hunt and Bentz, Bernie Bottomley with the Portland Business Alliance, and also for the purposes of this discussion, working with the Oregon Business Plan as the staff person on the Industrial Lands Task Force. You know, industrial lands are a little bit like the weather. Everybody complains about it, but nobody can do anything about it, it seems like. We'd like to talk to you about an idea that we think can do something about some of the issues that have been raised here, and get, I think, to Representative Smith's question about return on investment directly. I don't know if we have my slides, but yeah, I'll just...
put it on the way.
For this moment, I'll just go from your hard copy there. A couple of folks have talked about our study in the metro area where we did an analysis of available industrial lands. We showed a very small inventory of developable sites, and we identified a lot of constraints for sites that are potential industrial sites that are in the pipeline, wetlands, brownfields, and other infrastructure development needs that make those sites really not attractive in the short term. We looked at the sites that are in the pipeline. We looked at 12 of those sites to analyze in more detail the constraints and the challenges that those sites face. In order to do that, we modeled what that site might have in terms of industrial development on it. That allowed us to scope the size of the investment that would be needed in roads and sewer, but it also allowed us to identify the level of employment and the kind of wages and economic benefit that that site potentially could generate. On the constraint side, the issues that were paramount for these sites, a lot of them are off-site. So it's the road intersection 1,000 yards from the entrance of the site that will be at failure with the additional traffic once that site develops. It's the water and sewer facilities that are not on the site specifically, but are at the interceptor or at the treatment plant level. Transportation is a universal challenge for just about every industrial site that we looked at, and is also the most expensive in many of the sites. Site aggregation, where you have multiple ownerships, is a significant challenge for putting together larger sites. And as President Hughes mentioned, some of the tools that we've had in the past to do site aggregation are no longer available.
Do you want to jump in? Yeah, let's go ahead and jump in with a question. Co-chair Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. The first bullet point says off-site public utilities represent primary barrier. But that assumes a set of sites.
Yes, these are the findings just for the 12 sites that we analyzed in the Portland area that are in the pipe. We hope are in the pipeline to become available at some point. So these are just the challenges those 12 sites face.
Follow up. Yeah. And that's very helpful. This isn't then a comparison between those 12 sites and alternatives that might exist if we had more sites available, for example, ones across the magic line of the urban growth boundary.
I think in the Portland metro area, we looked at some of these, at least one of these sites that we looked at is outside the urban growth boundary, but inside the urban reserve area. And in our analysis, that site also faces many of the same challenges. Even if you brought it into your urban growth boundary, you would still have to put in sewer, water, and transportation facilities to serve it.
Thank you. So the key here is that we keep hopping back and forth between planning constraints on the one hand and infrastructure constraints on the other. And we need to keep them separate. And so if you could somehow address it in that fashion so that we understand what it is that we actually control when it comes to process as opposed to what it is we have to go find money for.
Sure. Now, I it's a good point, and it's one that I think you touched on in the previous presentation. There's two issues, and the issues vary in importance but community by community. In some communities, you have no land to do industrial development on. in that case, the infrastructure issue is not important. You have to have the land first.
Mr. Chair, if I may. You need to qualify that. You have no land. We have land. So when you say we have no land, you inside, need to follow that up.
Sorry.
But explain why we have no land.
Yeah, in some areas, we have no land inside the UGB that's, you know, that you could develop. In that case, the infrastructure problem is secondary. You don't have a piece of property to put the infrastructure into.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, and what is the primary problem there, then? Is it the UGB?
For those areas, it may be, yeah. It may be the UGB. It may be, you know, other issues. Annexation can be an issue in certain areas as well. So,
thank you.
Yeah. So in these particular cases, the primary issue was the infrastructure issue is what we were looking at. So you have to have both. You have to have a piece of property inside the UGB that you can develop, and in most cases, you have to have the infrastructure to serve it. Even once you have identified the constraints on the infrastructure side, in most of the cases we looked at, it would be a year or more to get that infrastructure put in. So there's a long lead time for these sites. And as President Hughes mentioned, a lot of the recruiting that we're doing these days, that Business Oregon is doing, those firms are looking at very short timelines to make a decision. And if you have a site that takes a year or two to get developed, a lot of times you're going to lose that potential new entrant to the market. And then in a number of cases, we identified a lack of knowledge about the piece of property itself as one of the constraints in moving projects forward. The owner and the potential developer don't necessarily know enough about the site, and neither has the kind of motivation to spend the money to find out that you need to do the due diligence. So one of the conclusions of the study was essentially that there's a market gap in developing some of these sites where the property value for industrial uses is not high enough currently and is not going to be high enough over a fairly long period of time, sometimes 20 to 30 years, for the market to close that gap. So there's a need for a public sector or private investor or patient investor to come into the market and help close that gap. So, as I mentioned, we scoped the size of the development and the kind of employment that these 12 sites would accommodate if they developed. And this just gives you a sense of scale of the benefit that developing these 12 sites could produce. 12,000 direct jobs, annual wages. We looked at traded sector industries, primarily manufacturing, $97,000 a year.
That's true.
Property taxes over 20 years of $217 million. But here's the real issue in terms of Representative Smith's question about return on investment. A 20-year state personal income tax benefit of $764 million. That's direct jobs, not including the indirect jobs. If you include the indirect jobs, that potential state personal tax revenue increase is $2.3 billion over 20 years.
Brittany, can I ask that mm-hmm. annual average wage level, it's not surprising to me that it's significantly above the Oregon or even the metro average. It is surprising that it's that high.
Yeah.
Does that surprise you?
It's fairly high. Two of the models that we did looked at clean tech and high tech electronics manufacturing in Washington County of a fairly large scale. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the manufacturing wage in Portland, it's very high. And part of that is because of Intel.
Sure.
So you have the same effect here. You have sort of modeling of a couple of high-end manufacturing facilities. But those are the kinds of things that we're trying to cite in the metro area.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Smith.
And this is where I hope we'll continue to consider, right, and that we think about unintended consequences and that advocates for industrial land, I'm hoping, are really coming to grips with. that if we're Intel and Genentech, that's sort of one sector of things, and if our objective is to raise average wage, that's one sector of things. If we, depending on the set of strategies we employ and are successful or not successful at, if we move and all of a sudden it's sort of easier for something south of FedEx Ground to take up all those opportunities, and we don't have any mechanism to sift through those offers, and there isn't the sort of market or regulatory pressure to move northward, then I think we could be missing opportunities rather than, you know, focusing ourselves to gain opportunities.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, and I think there's a mechanism in the proposal that we have that would move us in that direction. So I'll get to that in just a second. So just two specific examples, going back to Co-Chair Hunt's question about the wage rate. This is the example in Washington County with a high-tech manufacturing facility of a fairly significant scale, globally scaled high-tech facility. This shows you the property tax and state income tax benefit of that facility being built and staffing up over time. And you can see, and this model assumes, the reason the property tax is flat is it assumes an SIP or some kind of other incentive. But even if you exclude that, you can see that the property tax investment, or the return rather, is relatively modest compared to the state income tax benefit. And remember, it's the local jurisdiction that has put in the effort to build the sewer, build the water, build the road, and has taken the risk of putting in that infrastructure in anticipation of this client landing here. So they take the lion's share of the risk, they get the lamb's share of the benefit. This site has a cost gap of about $16 million. Without that gap being filled, it would be approximately 16 years until the site developed. So that's 16 years of the state not accruing that that income tax benefit. 1,700 direct jobs, 12,000 total jobs, 20-year state revenue of $153 million. And we used Johnson Reed, economist firm, used the in-plan model to develop the revenue projections, which is the same model that the state uses. The 20-year local revenue is $35 million, so you can just compare the $35 million to the $153 million, and you can see the relative benefit there, where the state receives about 80% of the new revenue, and that site, both direct and indirect, would generate something on the order of $2.8 billion in economic activity.
Bernie, if we could jump in for one question, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very interested in more jobs in the manufacturing sector, in industrial activity, and increasing our export economy. However, I start getting very concerned about how we encourage that. Are we encouraging it in the right way? One, I have a number of questions. There's only one specific one I want to ask you right now. You have mentioned the potential increased income tax revenue to the state. Of course, that helps support services that we're trying to fund. However, if we're talking about preparing sites in advance, that's really a speculative activity. Who's to say that rather than being used by a new business developing or in Oregon, expanding in Oregon or moving to Oregon, it's just moving around the pieces of the pie, and rather than a net increase in jobs, we just paid to make a really nice new site and did a lot of transportation stuff or cleaned up a brownfield or whatever, paid for a lot of stuff, and all that happened is one or more existing businesses moved to this nice new space, and now we have some other old sites sitting vacant.
Well, Co-Chairs Hunt and Bence, the question is who gets to say that doesn't happen, and under our proposal, you get to say that. So let me just get to that in 2 seconds.
Okay.
I just want to give one other example of a potential site development. This is more common, let's say. The first example was a globally scaled high-tech firm. You know, those are rare. We love to get them when they come. This is modeling a much more traditional manufacturing facility in the city of Sherwood. You can see that in this example, the local property tax and the state income tax revenue are closer, but it's still the state is gets the lion's share of the benefit. In this case, the site gap is $4.5 million, much smaller gap, although the time to market is still, you know, over a decade. If that gap isn't filled, a more modest 630 jobs, still a significant number of jobs. 20-year state revenue of $17 million and local revenue of $12 million. Here's our proposal. As you can see, there's a significant potential state benefit if these sites develop. And when the sites develop, the state does realize a significant increase in state income tax. Our proposal is to create a program that is essentially no risk to the state. So addressing Representative Nathanson's issue, the state would only participate when and if it realizes actual new revenue. So like urban renewal, each project would have to go through a but-for test. And the local project sponsor and Business Oregon is the entity that we've proposed, engage in a site-by-site evaluation and agreement where the two parties would come together and they would negotiate a proposal. The local jurisdiction would say, we want to develop this site. We expect it to be used for this kind of company and application. We expect it to have this many employees and to pay approximately this kind of wage. Business Oregon would ground truth that and say, okay, we think you're being a little too ambitious about, you know, what kind of firm you think you can land. Let's be more realistic. So they would, you know, go back and forth, and you'd come up with a sober assessment of what that site could actually accommodate and the kind of business that you could get on it. The locals would also propose what they kind of investment they would plan to make in that site, so what kind of sewer, water, and roads, and so forth would be needed, and Business Oregon would evaluate that relative to the kind of development that the site could support. So you want to make sure that the investment is appropriate for the type of development that you expect to get on that site. You don't want to build a 50-inch pipe if you're only going to need a 30-inch pipe, for example. With that in hand, and with those agreements, the site or the project would be eligible for a partially forgivable state loan. The local jurisdiction borrow the money and do the investments that they had agreed with Business Oregon that they would do. If the site never turns over, or if the site is used for something that is moving somebody across the street, then the loan isn't forgiven. The local jurisdiction's on the hook for the investment. On the other hand, if there is a new entrant to the market and there are new jobs and the state is realizing new revenue, then in our proposal, up to 50% of the loan would be forgivable based on the revenue that the state is actually getting. And the way that this has worked in other states, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Kansas, Missouri, and New Mexico all have some mechanism, either a sales tax or gross receipts tax version of this. The way that they structure it is that not 100% of the state's additional revenue is targeted for this program. So the state's gaining new revenue under any circumstance. They're just taking an allocation out of that new revenue to reimburse itself essentially for the loan. So that's how you ensure that it's not taking, you know, existing revenue out of the pocket, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And then to Representative Smith's question about how to use this to raise the level of the water table for wages and incomes, I think, at least in our thinking, in our analysis in the metro area, we looked at traded sector industries, which in general pay better wages than the average. And there are also the industries that are part of our economic development strategy, both at the state and regional and local level. And so we would propose that, you know, there be some threshold that Business Oregon develop, you know, with legislative input, that you would be targeting traded sector industries and that you would be looking at how you raise, you know, average wages. The difficulty there is that both in terms of scale and wages, you know, what Portland, what raises the average wage in Portland and is realistic is different than what might raise the average wage in Ontario or Ashland or, you know, someplace like that. So I think you want to have flexibility about how you set those goalposts. And, you know, in the Portland area, we're most interested in sites that are 25 acres and larger because those are the most difficult to amass, and they're also the ones that have sort of regionally significant, you know, game changers that locate on them. In other areas of the state, you know, 10, 15 acres is a big site and is really as big as they can accommodate or need. So, as I mentioned, the pre-investment agreement between the local sponsor, and by the way, when we talk about a local sponsor, we're thinking cities, counties, economic development entities, and ports primarily would be the kind of local entity that would engage in this kind of agreement with Business Oregon. Targeted at traded sector industries, you know, would have some kind of wage premium, although that needs to be flexible. Would have a but-for kind of evaluation that makes sure that this is not moving somebody from across the street and that the site investment plan costs and parameters are well understood by both the state and the local entity before any money is invested or expended. The other issue I mentioned is that for some of our sites, particularly site aggregation, there's a knowledge gap around the site. So we also have a proposal for a small grant program that would be eligible, available to local sponsors to do the kind of inventory that we've done in the metro area around the state, because there's a need for that, I think, in other communities we've heard from. Do due diligence on individual potential sites so that both the property owner and the potential developer can understand the constraints and the challenges that that site faces and the order of magnitude in terms of cost. And what our hope is, our expectation is that that will help bring additional private capital to the table because that knowledge gap prevents a lot of private capital from entering the market. So those are the thoughts. Both proposals are before you in kind of an outline sketch form. I'd like to turn it over to my compatriots here. Additional thoughts?
Go ahead. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair and committee members. My name is Ray Burstead. I am the president of the Strategic Economic Development Corporation representing Marion and Polk Counties. We have somewhat of a unique situation. You know, Salem is kind of the 900-pound gorilla in the middle of our region, and the city of Salem has done an inventory of industrial lands, and we're quite confident that we have now an existing 10-year supply of industrial lands to build on. We have large parcels, small parcels. We have the Mill Creek Corporate Center, which is over 500 acres. It's ready to develop. Infrastructure's in, ready to go. So we're feeling quite confident. On the other hand, 10 years in economic development times isn't very long, particularly if we ever come out of this recession and the opportunity for development really starts to expand itself. We've had a number of opportunities come about during the recession, the Sanyo Panasonic project, the Home Depot project, the FedEx project, a couple of those that have gone on regardless of the economy. But if the economy turns a 10-year inventory of industrial lands, I'm sure at that time, as Representative Smith has said, we'll be addressing urban growth boundary changes and the value of ag land versus the value of industrial land and how it compensates the economy. I would like to make my comments today more on the rural scale, and I'm talking about communities like Staten and Silverton and Mount Angel and Donald and Dallas and Independence, all of whom have industrial sites that could be easily developed if a program like this were put in place. Some of them need a rail spur. Some of them need some assessment done as to different types of things, you know, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's wetland mitigation, whether it's site certification, whatever it might be. These sites are smaller parcels, 10 to 20 to 30, 40, some of them 50-acre sites that are ideal expansion sites for local industries in our economy, particularly in the ag industry. As you're aware, Marion County and Polk County are 60% of our GDP comes from agriculture or ag-related projects. So these are rural sites that we feel this program could significantly benefit. And that's about all I had to say.
Great. Thank you.
My name is Steve Dahl. I do economic development for the City of Grants Pass down in Southern Oregon. I'm also president of the Oregon Economic Development Association this year. I'll give you a very specific site example for this. In the City of Grants Pass, we have an industrial area called Spalding Industrial Park. Well, Spalding Industrial Park is divided by Mill Stream, which is a stream that goes right through the middle of the park. It used to be a forest or timber products company. And we need about $2.5 million to get a sewer system and a lift station to be able to get over the stream into our sewer plant so we can make it available to industrial businesses to move into Spalding Industrial Park. Now, concerning your representation of, you know, building it and they will come and putting money in the ground and waiting for that to happen, Grants Pass has a history since 1999 when we first started developing Spalding Industrial Park. It usually takes 5 years on a national average before the first industrial business goes into the industrial park. Our first wave of Spalding sold out in 5 years. Our second wave in Spalding sold out, or is not sold out, we have six places remaining of it, about 35 acres, in 2 years after that. So there is definitely a need for industrial land down in Southern Oregon, especially in Grants Pass. You know, we don't have in the City of Grants Pass the $2.5 million to put in to the infrastructure to make it go. And Spalding's family doesn't have the $2.5 million to do it either. We can come up with probably about $1.5 million to come up to put in to do that, and we can borrow the rest from the state. But, you know, in my point of view, it would be great to have that forgivable loan or even a interest-only payment or no payment for 5 to 10 years until we get a business in there, be able to help encourage us to take that risk to go in there instead of going it all alone and making it work. As, you know, it's pointed out, the state gets money immediately after when the new hires of jobs or an increase of jobs come into the area. And with all respect to Representative Nathanson, I've been in economic development for 7 years now, and you know, Ray's been in a lot longer than I have. I've never heard a company come in and build a new building or build a new business without adding new employees to that in that direction. It's not, and if it has happened, it's usually done to increase or the efficiency of the area, and yeah, usually it ends up with higher wages to the people. So I mean, I don't see a loss in this from the state point of view coming in there, and even if you don't have new businesses coming in from a state's perspective, you're giving almost a guaranteed loan of, you know, let's do simple, a 2% loan. Right now on bonds, you're getting about 0.25% to 0.5% at the most, if you're really lucky. You know, that's going to in itself make itself money into for the state just on that loan process, because you're using money as capital to get more capital back into that. So you're getting some issues, you know. So to me, being able to forgive part of the loan or, like, you know, $500,000 of the project or something like that is a benefit to the communities, to encouraging communities to take those risks, to take those long-term thought processes. Because if not, you're not going to be able to get the owners of the land right now to be able to think those long-term processes and long-term investments and actually see a return on investment back. And that's not even considering all the, you know, the brownfields and all the stuff you have to go through that. Now, one part I would make a recommendation that would encourage you know, everything we've heard tonight, is that if you do participate in this long-term strategy or the forgivable loan process, that you have to bring up the site to be state certified or shovel-ready by the time to be able to qualify for that program. And that would encourage that type of activity from the communities to get it, instead of just decision-ready, to shovel-ready in that process. So anyway, that's kind of my thought on the subject, and any questions, happy to make up some answers.
Thank you. We are behind on time, so if you have, I'm sure these gentlemen would be happy to follow up on one. Are there any urgent questions right now, Representative Sheehan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really quickly, on the industrial site readiness draft, it mentions lottery funds. I assume that's from the economic development portion of those. And if so, how much do you anticipate that possibly being, and how much impact would that have on existing economic development programs?
Well, that's a good question. Representative Sheehan, I don't really have the answer to that. We're still working at the conceptual level of, you know, would the committee, would the body be open to the idea of a mechanism of this kind, scale. Looking at the 12 sites in the Portland area, closing the gap completely for all 12 sites would be about around $100 million. But you know, obviously, we wouldn't do all 12 sites all at the same time. So that's just a sense of, give you a sense of scale.
Representative Nathans.
Thank you. For now, I think I'll leave this as just a question that I will want answered for the future.
Sure.
It's in the direct site preparation assistance, it mentions forgivable loans to local governments and property owners. The benefit to the public, whether it's the state or local government, is different than the type of benefit that accrues to the private individual or the property owner. And I'm seeing a need to differentiate the kind of assistance and the kind of payback, frankly, because over time, what you might achieve through increased income tax revenue is different than what an individual property owner might realize from selling the property in 2 years or 10 or 50. So I will want to hear more about why this is designed to provide this type of loan assistance to not only local governments, but also to private individuals, and then how we differentiate what's fair to the public.
Yeah. We'll be happy to answer that. I mean, the quick answer is, co-chairs and Representative Nathanson, I think our expectation is that in each of these, you're probably going to have some kind of public or public-private partner, a port entity, a city, county. But we did want to encourage private sector capital to come into this arena, and so that's why the language is in
good.
There. Yeah.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate you being here. Appreciate your guidance. We're now going to move on to a series of issues. I invite Peter to come forward. A series of issues that are following up on bills we've passed as a legislature, task forces that have been established, projects that have been funded, and exercising our oversight function. So we're excited to have Peter Threlkell, and I think we'll get something up on the screen. If we can flip that switch. Demonstrating the user-friendliness of it. He doesn't even have it preloaded. He just types right in.
We'll see
and
if this works. Here we
voila.
Go. All right. Okay. Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, my name is Peter Threlkell. I'm the Director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's Office. Here to talk to you about the new Oregon business portal, the Business Express. This is the result of House Bill 3247 that came out of the 2009 session. The intent of the business portal is to make it easier for businesses to do business in Oregon. And We're going to, out of respect for time for you, your committee this morning, we're going to just dive right into the review of the portal, and I'll skip over the PowerPoint presentation. So as we set about planning the business portal, one of the things that we did is we went out and we talked to business owners, and we also talked to customer service staff at state agencies. We wanted to know, how did customers phrase their questions? How did they request information so that when we put up the portal, we would be able to present that information using language that the customers are familiar with and not using state agency jargon. Some of the things that we wanted to know, that we wanted to focus on what were tasks for small business owners as opposed to agency organization or agency silos. One of the things that we have with the business portal is you'll see right at the top we have a search engine, very prominent. This really follows along with the model of you're familiar with Google. It's just a search bar. Some of the leading state governments have also gone to very prominent search as a way to navigate and get information from the state. So we wanted to make sure that that was a key component of the new business portal. One of the things that we did, we've actually, this is a Google search engine in the portal. It actually restricts to business agencies within the state. So we don't look at, when you're on the business portal and you search here, you're not going to see results back from the Department of Education or other areas that don't have a focus on business. So we wanted to kind of limit some of that content down so we kind of remove the clutter and help help the business get to the information that they're looking for as quickly as possible. So it is a dynamic search. So as you start typing, you start to get results back. If we're looking for, somebody's looking for grant information, you could easily get to the Boost program that the legislature passed a couple of years ago. So you know, that was one of the features, the services we wanted to be able to provide, is that as a portal, it's really that gateway to the information and services that the state has. We didn't want to duplicate what other agencies have done, but we wanted to make sure that there was just a very quick path to get there. We have our top-level navigation, and this is all organized around tasks that a business might want to do. One of the things as we were developing the portal, we had gone out and we had studied best practices of all the other states that have business portals. Every single one of them, of the best states, were all organized around life cycle events of a business. That was plan, start, grow, operate, move your business, or relocate. And that was really what we came up with in our top level navigation for the first prototype. We took that out to and did usability tests with actual business customers. We went out to small business development centers. We talked to businesses. We sent the prototype out to every chamber of commerce in the state. And the feedback that we got back was nobody was ever going to use that that life cycle navigation. They wanted to focus on tax or tasks. You know, how do I pay taxes? How do I register a business? How do I report new employees? Those were the types of things. So we retooled it and we came back in. And so our top level navigation really looks at what are those tasks that businesses want to do. If you go out and look at other state business portals, you're going to see that ours is different. But we believe that delivering what Oregon business customers want is the right way to go. And we actually think that they may have got it wrong. One of the things that we have some what we call personas. These are some of the different areas that if you're a veteran-owned business or a small business or a minority or women business, there's specific talk content for you there. As we go down further into the page, we have information. We do have a startup toolkit. This is the actual one life cycle topic that businesses would use, and we've set this up to just be a very quick few steps that a business can go through to really get started in this state. You know, pick your name and your structure with my office, register your business, get tax numbers, that information, and we've tried to make it as simple as possible to just really step the business through those processes and get them going and started. Am I compliant? This is something I find really interesting. As we talked to business, we hadn't planned this piece. But when we went out and talked to businesses, the thing that just kept coming back time and time again that was important to businesses and what they wanted to know is, am I compliant? Am I doing it right? And so we put this piece together, and this is an area that I think, you know, in the coming months and years, we're going to be looking at how do we improve upon this, because this was so especially important to businesses. And I think when you talk to them, the vast majority, they're interested in following the law and doing it right, and you know, they want to know that I'm not going to run afoul of the state or the government. So we want to look at how this component of the site can really serve businesses better. There's a lot of contracting opportunities in the state. This is really serving as sort of a sub-portal for contracting with all levels of the state. There's a lot of tools and services there. We set up a training and events calendar, so there's a lot of training events that are available. You know, if you're have a business event or a chamber of commerce, you can submit those to us, and we can get those posted and help cover that information so that, you know, people know that there are events coming up or a training or information that they could go and attend. One of the things that we did want to do with the business portal, and we've felt was very important, is we knew that 40% of the internet is now accessed via mobile device, and so I think the version you're seeing there is how this would look on a laptop. So we designed the site to be responsive to whatever size of screen. It recognizes the device that you're accessing is from, so as you come in, you notice that we change when you're looking at from a tablet. But also, if you're coming to the site from your smartphone, you get a very different view. So what we've done is we basically, in the past, we've had to build three different websites to deliver this type of functionality. We've built this once, and it just recognizes what you're coming from. Some of the private sector, this is probably not that cutting edge, but so far we're the first and only state that has this type of mobile app functionality on a website or a business portal. So if you're on your smartphone, you still have access. We want to be able to deliver anytime, anywhere, and any device that you want to use. So just briefly, these are the agencies that the key agencies that we worked with. They were excellent partners with us. I think when we had a recent conversation, and one of them had made the comment that why this project was so easy was that it really was just a no-brainer. It was something that just needed to be done, and everybody bought in and was on board. The nine here, but we also talked to quite a few other agencies that we haven't been able to list and got their information to make this site possible.
Where's the Oregon investment?
So if you have any questions.
Great. Mr. Smith.
It looks great. What remains to, is it all finished and done and launched, and so feedback is helpful, or that means feedback is not helpful, or are there still things that remain to be done?
Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Smith, feedback is always helpful. We do have there's a contact us section if people want to provide information or if there are questions, if they think that things are missing, that we want to add stuff. If it didn't provide the information of the service, we want to hear from people. So we really want to be able to serve folks. One of the things that we are still working on that was in the original bill that we haven't been able to, we didn't get accomplished when this went live into production, was really the component around local government. So we're working on that now, bringing in ordinances, regulations, information about some of the local governments around the state. So that'll be a sort of a new development that you'll see as we look to enhance it with that information. You know, going forward, you know, we just look for as new developments, new tools, new services are provided by the state that are out there for business, we want to make sure that we get them in, get them featured, so that there's really the one place that people can go and find all that information.
Please. Thanks for sure. Two little things. One, little things. When I'm looking at the main page, I've reloaded a few times. Contracting with Oregon, I assume that's a state of Oregon. That's the logo, but mine only fills about a third of the way. And training events, I get no logo. So that's just one little data point. Maybe you guys have run it through a lot of tests, and it's a rare thing that happens on a Macintosh. I don't know. But the bigger thing is if I do a Google search for the good news is if I do a good Google search for Business Express across the country, this comes up first. The not as good news is if I do Oregon business, this doesn't come up on the first page.
Okay.
So we might want to do search engine optimization for the Oregon business.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Lizzie.
Thank you. I apologize if I missed this, but is there a nice domain name for this instead of cms.org.gov?
I like that one. It's hot.
If not, that would be good. But my question, the substantive question, is Oregon Investment Act. Is there any discussion on developing that somehow, especially identifying sources for businesses?
For financing?
Yeah.
Okay. Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Lindsay, Oregon.gov is in transition right now. They're moving from one provider to the new provider that we worked with on this site. So that's why you see some of this long URL. Our actual URL is Oregon.business.gov. So pretty short and concise. But this is accessible from the homepage. When we go look at some of the information around financing, Business Oregon has their business finance widget. We have a lot of the information around some incentives, loan programs, and other information. So I don't know if that was the investment council information that you were looking for, or.
Well, that's what kind of tipped me off on that. And just going back to what we passed, Oregon Investment Act, is the intent was to go out and scrub all of the available opportunities and programs that are in place and consolidate them into one area. So I hope that that's what will happen at some point, is there's a consolidation. So people that are looking for debt financing or equity financing, whatever the case may be, they have a single source to go and investigate.
So that type of information as that content is created on that, whether that's Business Oregon or the state treasurer, we would be looking for to feature and host that here as well.
And actually, if you do click on the business finance widget, it does give you a series of places, and it shows all the various and sundry agencies that they are currently resident in. But you're right, I think, especially the legislature in 2013. Consolidates, reforms, better coordinates those. Hopefully that will. But they are actually all, at least many of them, are listed out on a single site. It kind of illustrates the importance of the need for consolidation. Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really quick, I don't want Mayor Smith to stand alone and pickiness.
That, it's a jinx.
On iOS devices here, on the drop-down menu, it does not work.
Which one?
On iPads, or I suppose you have a different site on iPhone, but if you're looking at this with a web browser on an iPad, the drop-down navigation actually pops out really quickly, but then disappears as it goes to a different page.
Okay.
There's a way around. There's a way to fix that.
Again, can I, Mr. Chair, I admit when you and I talked on the phone, I think you mentioned that this is optimized for Google Chrome, Firefox,
Chrome,
but less useful or not useful at all for Internet Explorer.
Some of the functionality.
Nobody has that.
It doesn't work very well with Internet Explorer at the moment. So, and I think that is a really good point that we've actually seen more struggles with in the last year than I think we have in previous times is with all the changes and revisions with the different browsers out there. It is becoming exceedingly difficult and frustrating to try and keep up with all those versions and make sure that the testing and the functionality works on all those platforms. But we want to be able to deliver the services, you know, wherever the customers are using them. So that's part of that challenge for us is that we go back in and are diligent about doing that testing and making those modifications so that it does work on all those services, all those browsers, platforms.
Thank you very much for coming in, and thank you to you and your team for your great partnership working on this in the implementation and for being so proactive in reaching out to businesses to really solicit needs and have something that's going to be relevant and user-friendly for them.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here today. So let's move on to transportation. Travis, you are up. Welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hunt. Co-Chair Bentz, members of the committee, I am Travis Brower. I'm ODOT's Federal Affairs Advisor. And today I'm here to give you a pretty quick briefing on MAP 21, which is the new Federal Surface Transportation Authorization Act and has actually some good news for Oregon. MAP 21 stands for Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century. And I think that we would agree that the bill does, in fact, move the transportation system ahead in the 21st century. I'm going to talk pretty quickly. It's a 584-page bill, so forgive me if I gloss over some of the key details, but I'll give you a brief review of some of the key accomplishments of MAP 21. The first and probably most important and most interesting piece is the stable funding that MAP 21 provides, but only for the short term. MAP 21 authorizes the federal highway transit and safety programs for the next 2 years, federal fiscal year 2013 and federal fiscal year 2014. And over that period, MAP 21 essentially has funding that is flat. I included a chart in your testimony on the last page that shows you the impact of the funding levels and the formulas in MAP 21 on Oregon's federal highway funding. That shows you that in 2010, we had essentially the high water mark of federal highway funding, and since then, it's been down a little bit, and it's going to be, it was down this year, about 7%. In 2013, we see that MAP 21 will be about flat for Oregon's federal highway funding and also for 2014. That's actually a good thing, though, oddly enough. Someone told me recently that in the public sector, flat is the new up. And in that case, we're up, and it's a lot better than the one-third funding cut that we were looking at last year when the House, U.S. House, was proposing a significant cut in federal highway and transit funding. I should add that transit funding is actually up just a little bit, and Oregon, under both the highway and transit formulas that were included in how they distribute the funding, does pretty well. On the highway side, Oregon will receive a larger share of funding than in the past, and you can thank Congressman DeFazio in part for that. So if you see him, give him a big hug. I'm sure he'd appreciate that. He was able to, just with some of the helpful features of the formula, Oregon will get about $27 million more per year just by increasing the share of the funding. That partially offsets the overall size of the pie getting a little bit smaller. The important thing to note, though, is that the Highway Trust Fund is still facing a long-term shortfall. Every year, the Highway Trust Fund is taking in about $12 billion less than the funding level that Congress has approved. So the only way that Congress was able to avoid a deep cut to funding in MAP 21 was to transfer $20 billion of general fund money from a variety of rather interesting sources into the Highway Trust Fund. That money will get us through federal fiscal year 2014, and then after that, Congress will either have to cut funding by about 25% or find additional revenue on an ongoing basis to avoid a deep cut. That's why in that funding chart that we included in the testimony, you'll see that in 2015 and beyond, we could see a reduction in our federal highway funding of about $110, $120 million a year, about 25% cut. That makes it very uncertain in the future and very difficult for us to plan those long-term capital programs and projects that, you know, we're currently actually working on our 2015 to 2018 statewide transportation improvement program. So we're already past MAP 21 at some level and have to make projections on how much money will be available. Beyond the funding, there were a number of key features in MAP 21 that are worth mentioning. One is there's greater flexibility for states and local governments. They consolidated the program structure significantly, which had gotten a bit overly complex. And as a result, there's now more flexibility to invest in priority areas. Along with that, however, comes with greater accountability for results and outcomes. In the past, the Federal Surface Transportation Program didn't really focus on results. The federal government didn't require states to measure outcomes or hold them accountable for how they spent the money. Of course, most states already had pretty good performance management systems in place. Oregon was recognized last year as having one of the six best performance management systems for our transportation program among the states. Under MAP 21, there is a greater focus on performance and accountability, where USDOT will set performance measures based on the bill, and then states will set targets and have to explain how they are making progress toward meeting those targets. There's also a pretty significant focus on freight within the bill, which is, for a traded sector economy like Oregon's, a very important part of this bill that we strongly advocated for. The Secretary of the Transportation will designate a primary freight network, which will cover most of the highway routes that carry most of the freight in the nation. They'll develop a national strategic transportation or national strategic freight plan that will look at some of those bottlenecks on that system and try to find ways to alleviate those bottlenecks. And there'll be performance measures for the movement of freight as well. Unfortunately, in the conference committee, the compromise between the House and the Senate, they killed off a separate freight program that would have provided a dedicated investment stream for freight projects. But you can certainly see that with these policy provisions, they are laying the groundwork for long-term investments by states and the federal government in the freight system. I should also note that there are streamlined project delivery opportunities where the federal government will make the process a little bit easier, perhaps. More projects will be able to go through what's called a categorical exclusion that doesn't require an environmental assessment or an environmental impact statement if it's just your basic everyday paving project within the highway right-of-way, for example. They'll also allow some limited opportunities to purchase right-of-way, a property for projects, before the environmental process is completed. We're going to be looking at aggressively using some of these new opportunities. Oregon has always been a leader in finding ways to streamline project delivery, save time, save money, while actually improving environmental outcomes. We showed we could do that under the OTIA 3 program, and we think MAP 21 will help us in that regard. The other area that I think is a significant accomplishment for MAP 21 is in financing assistance for major projects. The only program that received a significant increase in funding was the TIFIA program, the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, if you would like to know the acronym. That program was expanded sevenfold from it was going to offer about $1.75 billion in financing assistance, which actually leverages 10 times that, about $17 billion in federal loans and loan guarantees for major projects. That will be particularly helpful for the Columbia River Crossing, which will now have a major source to compete for a significant federal loan that would be used or paid back through the tolling revenue streams. We're looking at a situation here where the CRC could request a TIFIA loan of up to about $1 billion, which, because of favorable financing terms, generally leverages about 25% more cash from the same revenue stream as, say, a general obligation bond, and even a lot more than that than, say, a tolling bond, which is a little bit riskier product. So we're looking at a situation where this Columbia River Crossing could leverage perhaps an additional $200 million, as much as that, from a TIFIA loan. So with that, I'll answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. I don't know if it's a question. Do you know what the discussion has been at the federal level regarding using rail to alleviate freight congestion? Because if all the money is going only into highways, you know, one rail car takes the place of many, many trucks on the road. So when we're talking about freight congestion, I think we have to talk about both modes.
Co-Chair Jefferson and Nathanson, Map 21 was interesting in that there were some efforts to include a more comprehensive view of the transportation system. Typically, this it used to be called the Highway Bill. Now we call it the Surface Transportation Bill, with the notable exception that there's usually not much to do with rail in it. There was an effort to include a rail title and to have, especially on the freight side, a more comprehensive freight program that would include the rail system. That fell apart due to partisan bickering in the Senate, and as a result, the rail title was stripped from the bill, and the rail freight provisions were also stripped from the bill, leaving a more highway-centric policy framework. However, USDOT is looking at this, and they're forming a freight policy council that is actually going to look at all the modes of the transportation system, from air to rail to marine as well. And so I think they're going to take these highway freight provisions and expand that. Of course, there's no funding to go along with it, but at least there will be a policy framework in place.
Thank you. I'm disappointed it fell apart, but thank you. I'm glad people are still keeping the idea moving forward.
Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we talked on the phone about this after the National Conference of State Legislatures. When I heard about this MAP 21 program, I was excited that we might have some funding for the CRC, but it sounds like you were planning on this being renewed in all the budgeting, so there's really not any new money for any projects. Are there, and so with some of your other projections, I know the federal gas tax is set to sunset. Are we expecting that's going to be renewed with some of these projections for the federal funding, or are you planning for worst-case scenarios?
Mm-hmm. Co-Chairs, Representative Sheehan, the federal gas tax is set to sunset. I don't remember when the date is. Typically, that's been a fairly normal process of renewing that as part of either reauthorization or some other extension. So we don't expect that the federal gas tax will sunset. However, the federal gas tax is facing the same challenges as the state gas tax with more fuel-efficient vehicles, particularly with the new fuel efficiency standards. So yes, we've done some scenario analysis looking out at what the long-term impact could be, and it's not pretty. Already, the Federal Highway Trust Fund is running a massive deficit, not taking in enough revenue to cover its expenditures without transfers of additional resources. If some of the fuel efficiency standards have an impact, as some have projected, we could actually see a declining federal gas tax over the long term. And that is a great concern, because the federal funding now is essentially almost the entirety of our capital program, because we are now in a situation where the state gas tax is largely going to debt service and agency operations and maintenance of the transportation system.
A really quick follow-up. Back on the projections and estimating what things are going to cost, when you say that we could potentially generate an extra $200 million in additional resources for the CRC, is that already factored into the Oregon payments of this? When we're looking at an Oregon investment of $450 million, are we already factoring in getting that $200 million, or is that additional?
Co-Chair, Representative Sheehan, yes, that is factored into the tolling portion of the CRC's finance plan.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very comprehensive and very helpful. We'll give Congressman DeFazio a hug. We'll be sure to tell him that you suggested it.
I'm sure he'll appreciate it.
Thanks, Travis.
Paul,
welcome back. Again, we've asked Paul to come and give us an update on the status of some of the big projects that the state has funded.
Good. Thank you, Chair Hunt, members of the committee. Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. I'll try to move through this quickly, several projects to talk about. I want to start with JTA, the bill that passed in the 09 session, the Jobs and Transportation Act. As you know, there were several projects that were specifically identified in the bill. In my testimony, you'll find one of the handouts lists each one of those and the status of those. I'm going to hit highlights of a few of those. But I think one of the things to kind of take away from my briefing here on the JTA projects is we've really done the kind of the low-hanging fruit, the easy projects we've had out to construction or completed in the process. What we're now about to embark on is the much larger projects, those that have required environmental documents, much more complexities in the development process. There's many projects that are going to go to construction in the next 12 months, including the Sunrise Corridor, Chute Road Interchange, on Highway 26, the Woodburn Interchange, Newburgh-Dundee, Kugler Interchange, Fern Valley, which is just south of Medford on I-5, the Biggs Interchange on 84, and then a climbing lane just out of LaGrange on 84. So those are the more significant projects that were identified in the bill, and you're going to see those construction, those all happen. Tying in a little bit with Travis's previous presentation, when we look at an overall kind of revenue stream for the volume of projects that we have, this is really kind of the last big kind of bubble that we're going to go through for transportation. Once we come out of the Jobs and Transportation Act projects, these ones that I listed, you're going to see a dramatic reduction in the amount of funding and the amount of projects that we have, especially given the life of the funding life of MAP 21 being only through 14. The timing of both those coming together is we're starting to design an organization that's much smaller to kind of live within the amount of funds that we do have for transportation projects. So that's work we're also doing kind of behind the scenes to get past these large projects. So let me just quickly run through some of the projects that are underway or in design. Glencoe Interchange on Highway 26 is a project that's started construction this summer. Here's a photograph showing some of the work that's underway. This photograph shows some of the design features of the interchange. It's basically an interchange upgrade for that interchange as it serves North Plains, Cornelius, Hillsborough, Forest Grove. It's about a $32 million project that should be completed by 2014. Another significant event over the summer was the Newburgh-Dundee project. This has been a long process to get this project to where it's at. One of the key milestones was a record of decision that we got in June, and then just last month we got the goal exception from the Yamhill County Commission was approved. So those are very significant milestones in the project, and we had a little celebration of that a few weeks ago. Actual construction will begin in the spring of this project. We've designed this to have several different contracts that will be going on this project, not one big contract, but several smaller series of projects, so they'll begin this this spring. One of the reasons we did that was just to have more competition and just open up this project to some of the medium or smaller size contractors in the area to compete for. Another project that I mentioned earlier that's going to be underway this next spring, this summer, is the Woodburn Interchange project. We're completing the design and right-of-way acquisition on that project. I highlight this one just because of there was a number of projects in the JTA Act that when the assumption of the funding strategy for each one of them assumed a earmark from the congressional bill that Travis just talked about, and since we didn't receive earmarks for any of those projects, we've been designing the projects or using our practical design approach to scale those projects back to within the means we have. The one exception to that we haven't been able to is the Woodburn Interchange, and we still have about a $10 million gap on this project that we'll be looking to fill between now and the spring when we let the project. One piece of good news that we were able to achieve about a $3.3 million discretionary grant from Congress just last month. So that does help, but we still have about a $10 million gap on this project. Moving on to the OTIA 3 bridge program. It's been almost 10 years since that bill passed the legislature in the 03 session. The bill was charged for ODOT to deliver 365 bridges and secure the strategic network of freight routes in the state from the bridge issues that we were seeing. All of those projects except two will be completed at the end of this construction season, and the two projects that we have are the Sandy River Bridge, which you're looking at a picture of here on 84, and then the Willamette River Bridge in Eugene. Both these projects are four-year-plus projects in construction, and so they're going to go beyond our goal of the 2012 completion of the program. But overall, the program has been a very good success. We continue to be on schedule with our projects as well as under budget for the whole program. The particular project here, the Sandy River Bridge, we're just about ready to open traffic to this bridge, as you've seen under construction here. This picture was actually taken earlier this year, but by the end of the month we should have both directions of traffic east and west on the new bridge, and then we'll begin constructing the twin to this bridge for the westbound traffic. So it's just about to the halfway point of completing this project. Here's some of the beams that we're putting in place this summer. The other significant project still underway is the Willamette River Bridge in Eugene, and here's a picture of the one of the structures that's complete, that's carrying both directions of I-5, and here's its twin structure that's under construction currently. So both these projects continue to move along nicely. Again, very large projects, but we continue to move along nicely with both those projects. One last project I want to touch on with Pioneer Mountain to Eddyville project. This is the project on Highway 20 between Corvallis and Newport. I briefed you last spring on our settlement with YRC, or Granite Construction. And since that settlement agreement was signed with them, ODOT has taken control of the project, and we've been aggressive this summer in doing work on the project. The work has been focused on stabilizing the landslides. We've been doing what we call horizontal drilling to relieve water pressure in the slides, as well as some other work to stabilize those landslides. We also have been removing the bridges as we change the design from a bridge design to a culvert design on the project. We also continue working on the completion of the design of the project, which we anticipate early next year to go out to bid and have that contract underway by next summer. The overall completion of the project is targeted to have open to traffic by 2015. Just in my testimony, you'll see the Connect Oregon projects. Just to note that our Transportation Commission approved 38 projects for the $40 million in Connect Oregon funds that were approved last session. We had 64 total applications for over $71 million that applied for those. And again, we came up with a good set of projects and continue to have a large appetite out there for those non-highway projects. So that concludes my testimony. Any questions?
Questions for Paul? Good. Thanks for the
update. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's move on to the Road User Fee Task Force. Jim, come on down.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Whitty. I'm a manager of ODOT's Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding. Today I'm here to give you an update on the activities of the Road User Fee Task Force. I'm not going to use the slides on the screen. I'll use them on the paper, and there's enough for people in the back to look at the testimony. Just to remind you, the purpose of what the activities, which is to do a road user charge pilot program to start very soon, is to demonstrate the rudiments of a future system of road user charging. It'll be open to enable the marketplace to provide the technologies. There'll be four mileage reporting options, so that we'll have choice on the part of the motorists. And there'll be a private sector administration alternative to the to ODOT, and a multi-state application. So since May, we've selected three firms to provide the services: Sanef, IMS, and Raytheon. CH2M will operate the pilot, and D'Artagnan will provide the tax accounting. There'll be almost 50 volunteers for the pilot, and some of them are sitting here with us in the room behind the dais there. And thank you for volunteering. There are still spots available for any of you that still want to join. We're also having the Transportation Commissioners participate, as well as many of the members of the Road User Fee Task Force. There'll be many vehicle types. This isn't about a particular vehicle. The volunteers will pay 1.56 cents per mile and receive a fuel tax rebate. And Washington and Nevada will join the pilot with their own volunteers that they will manage. They will use our system, but they will manage their own volunteers. They've selected them. They cannot actually have them pay the charge because they don't have legislative authority to do so like Oregon does. But they'll have an illustrative billing. So we'll have that multi-state activity going on. The volunteers, before the end of this month, will sign a simple contract. It's a page and a half with a lot of white space. We made a lot of very, very simple. They will then enroll online and choose a method for reporting their miles. Four options. You see this on the first slide following the introductory slide. Four options, a basic plan, and as you can see, I have the unit right here. I pulled it out of my car, actually, because I'm testing this right at the moment. It has no GPS technology whatsoever in it. Reports all miles that I drive. Then the second option will be the smartphone plan. That is this device. It also has no GPS technology whatsoever, but does have the ability to connect to an app on an Android smartphone. So if somebody wants to exclude out-of-state miles by their choice, they can activate that app when they go out-of-state. And then the third option is the GPS device that will not only exclude out-of-state miles from taxation, but also exclude off-public road miles from taxation for those that have that an interest in doing so in the system. But these are choices that people make. We will not force them into one or the other. It's their choices. And then the fourth option, for those that simply are spooked by technology, they can choose the flat prepaid rate plan, which is a high number, $45 times the number of months in the pilot. Not something I think anyone will choose, but it is an option that we think people might be interested in the future, and so we have it available in the pilot. Installation, which should go to the next slide on the presentation, will be easy. I did it myself. Actually, my wife and I did it with each other. It takes about a minute to find the port because you have to find it in the wheel, the well underneath the steering wheel. It's what's used for doing diagnostics for air quality, and people can actually do that on their own in the air quality testing now. So you have to find that port, and it took us about 4 minutes actually, because we started with where is it? We got the book out from the car, and you can't find it in the book. You need to search around and find it. It's very easy to find. And then I said, "You try it." She snapped it right in a second. It's very, very simple to do. Easier than doing the same thing with computers. But even so, we're going to provide a help desk so the people that need help can get it immediately. And for state legislators, there'll be personal service if you'd like it. So they also select a tax processor account manager, which will be either ODOT or a private sector firm called SANA. We want to demonstrate that there'll be more than one option for tax processing as well. Okay, this is just, it'll be a simple system and easy to use. Frankly, when I installed this one, I haven't noticed it because it kind of disappears in the car and you forget about it completely, which is delightful. But what we're going to experience in the pilot here is kind of the basics of a future system. There'll be more options in the future. For example, there'll be an iPhone app. There'll be telematics that are in cars will be used, things like OnStar and Ford Sync and Nissan Car Wings. Those things will be used in the future. And we think there should be ODOT. This is not the task force. ODOT believes there should be a non-technology-related option that isn't a high flat fee. We think that there'll be people that want that, and we think that should be developed. But it'll take some time because that'll involve many more people. rather than technology. So that's when we want to look on in the future. You see a timeline on the last slide there that talks about starting in October with installations, and then the system will switch on right around November 1st. For legislators, if the campaign is an issue, we can delay some of this until post-election. Just let us know. So we have the fleet forecast coming in December, which will predict future revenues based on changes in the vehicles. We have the urban-rural analysis, which will indicate impact of the system on rural drivers and versus urban drivers, and see if there's a difference there. And then this is all in preparation, of course, for legislation that the Road User Fee Task Force is preparing for the 2013 session, and they'll make the final decisions on what those provisions are tomorrow at the meeting in the Capitol Building in Room 50 in the basement. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That concludes my testimony.
Representative Shield.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. Number one, what is the mechanism for reporting once that has collected that data in your car? And number two, what happens if I need to go on a road trip and I just pull the thing out for the trip and then come back and put it back in, you know, when it comes to just defrauding the system? What's in place to prevent that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Sheehan, these devices don't just record miles. They actually send it wirelessly to the tax processor you've selected.
Okay.
So, that can be done many different ways. There's not any particular one choice. As far as taking it out, there are ways for the device to recognize, based on how it reads the engine control unit, whether there was a gap in driving between taking out and then putting back in. So that gap could be investigated by the tax processor to say, well, why was there a gap? This technology is being deployed really for the first time here. Although the pay-as-you-drive insurance industry, which is worldwide now, has already managed this issue. So okay. It's just that we haven't taken the time to investigate all options yet that are developed. All you can really do when you do an RFP is take what comes in. But in the future, we'll be able to do that once we get the system up and going and it's been authorized by the legislature.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate the update. Let's move on to a report from the At-Risk Driver Work Group following on legislation passed last session. Invite Jim and Amy to join us. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Hunt, Chair Benz, members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation here to merely introduce this presentation. This has to do with House Bill 3185 from the 2011 session that directed ODOT to assemble a work group to study the at-risk driver program. And the work group has done so and created a report, and the legislation also directed us to present that to the legislature. So with me today is Jim Ilg, who is the chair of this work group. Jim is an occupational therapist at Salem Hospital and has been so for the last 15 years and is a certified rehabilitation driving specialist. So at this time, I would simply turn it over to Jim to address the report. Thank you.
Good morning. So as
introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Jim Ilg. I'm an occupational therapist. I was the chairperson that helped address House Bill 3185. And as Amy said, we were looking at the at-risk drivers program that was administered by DMV, and we were asked to make any changes or recommendations to that policy. Just a brief statement about the at-risk drivers program. It is the at-risk drivers program is impairment-based, and age alone does not deem somebody to be retested in the DMV system. And so we were asked to look at different things under the bill, and some of them included identifying any barriers for the medical professions in the reporting process, to consider if there are any evidence-based assessments or tools that might predict somebody's ability to safely drive or predict future crashes with them. And then another thing was to consider if age-based testing is appropriate for us to start looking at. The work group consisted of individuals in the medical field, the study of aging, law enforcement agents was involved there, driver safety education, and occupational therapists. We met over an 8-month period and looked at a lot of research and discussed all of the information that was given to us. And basically what we have, highlighting the specific recommendations and findings, currently the at-risk program that the DMV has, we feel like that's running actually really smoothly and doing a good job at identifying people that are at risk through the using the healthcare system as one agent. There's no simple or practical assessment tool out there that would indicate somebody whether they're a safe driver or not, or to predict future crash risk. We recommended that DMV not institute an age-based renewal frequency or testing process within their system. And we also recommend that we look at clarifying the reporting standards for the medical professionals. And then finally, one other thing that we are recommending is to amend the statute to provide civil immunity for all medical professionals who report patients under the non-mandatory reporting system. So currently under the mandatory system, primary care physicians will report a person if they feel like they are at risk, and they are immune from civil liability. Under the non-mandatory people, it's my understanding that there is civil liability held there. So we feel like you would get more people referring people into the process if that was also included for non-mandatory. That's a basic summary of what we did and found. Any questions?
As you have come to these recommendations, were any of them close calls in the group, or would you describe them all as pretty much being consensus?
Pretty much good consensus on all the way. Our recommendation, though, is really as we move forward and as the aging population grows, we recommend that DMV continue to look at the research and continue to identify if there is an assessment tool out there, because from a medical standpoint, there's going to be a lot of research being done, and it's looked at all the time. So.
Any other questions?
Yeah, that's right. You indicated you're recommending a statutory change. Is there a vehicle that that ODOT is planning to bring forward on this or something?
Chair Hunt, Chair Benson, Mr. Brennan, the work group did recommend one legislative change. ODOT has not brought forward a vehicle for that. In discussions with Representative Berger, who is the champion of this bill, she indicated to me that if it is the committee's pleasure to introduce that bill, that would be fine. Otherwise, she would introduce it and just to communicate that so that the bill can be introduced.
Yeah, that's a good question. So we'll add that to our placeholder list. Co-Chair Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Have there been lawsuits against doctors? Is that why the suggestion?
I don't know the answer to that. I think I sat on the committee in 2001 and 2003, and I recall that there was a physician in Bend that lost his practice over something like this. And that was a discussion, but I'm not 100% sure if that's factual. But I think that was the case. I think another big issue is primary care physicians. We sent out a study for asking the primary care physicians just questions about the whole process. One of their big concerns is bringing this up to their patients. They lose patients because if you're being asked about your driving, that is a big independence thing for people. And if you're going to be asking that, they would rather not see their physician. And that's happened a number of times.
Hold on, Mr. Chair. HIPAA laws are going to be difficult.
I believe that was addressed in 2001, 2003, where it, I think there's a, I'm not sure what they call it, there's a process with DMV that it's okay for medical community to share medical information with them. I did interrupt you, sorry.
No, that's fine. It would be interesting to see what the foundation for the loss of the practice, what was the legal theory that allowed the person hurt to sue the doctor, so we better understood what it was, why we're granting this immunity.
Yeah.
Chair Bence, Chair Hunt, I'd be happy to follow up and provide you information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, we appreciate the work of the task force, and thanks for coming in to report. We've got a few minutes set aside at the end, as was mentioned, related to that potential committee bill. We are coming up on the deadline for committee bill concepts to be introduced. Patrick, can you remind us of the coming deadlines?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The deadline that's upcoming is Monday, the 17th of September. That deadline is only for submission of concepts to Legislative Council. If the committee bills can be considered by legislative concepts that were submitted by members as well as by committee staff, the date when those would be when those would be adopted as committee bills, I believe, will be the December meeting, but I could be wrong on that. It could be the January meeting. There is a date when Legislative Council has to have them back, and it would be the meeting immediately following, the committee meeting immediately following that date. But Monday the 17th is date when committee bill concepts by staff or by legislators for individual or committee bill concepts need to be submitted to Legislative Council.
So are there any particular concepts that anyone would like to have submitted as a committee request of Legislative Council versus an individual member requests?
Mr. Chair, just a note, I don't have one at this point, but it is also worth remembering that individuals can submit bills as a request, as an individual request, and then subsequently they can turn into committee bills.
Yep. That can be crossed either direction. It's the deadline that's up first is just physically starting is getting in under the wire, making sure the Legislative Council is drafting the bill. So whether it's introduced as a member bill later or as a committee bill, that at least remains a viable option. Whereas if this deadline is passed and there's nothing being drafted, then you'd have to borrow priority later or try and stuff it into another bill. All members are going to introduce their bills as member bills, it looks like.
Or at least draft
is fine. Okay, well, that's why we only set aside a few minutes.
It's good news as a staff person.
Anything else for the good of the order? Representative Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to report to the committee. I got on the Transportation Standing Committee at NCSL and came back from Chicago, where we had that conference. I got two things on the agenda, which for the lobbyists at NCSL to be pushing at the federal level. Number one is I asked them to take Connect Oregon as a model and see if they can push legislation to have matching funds at the federal level for states that have that type of a program. After Chicago had all sorts of pork that they had gotten for a similar project, I'm sure, which has nothing to do with our president. But the other thing having to do with the vehicle usage tax and putting their folks to work on finding some federal solution for that as well, because as was stated in testimony, it's going to be a continual downward slope if we continue on with the gas tax. So I just wanted to let you know that's two things that I got, and I think there were only four things that were put on the agenda, so Oregon got two of them.
Correct. And more funding for Illinois may be more related to the fact that the transportation secretary is from Illinois. Maybe coming.
I think it all helps.
Anything else for the good of the order? Okay. Thank you all. Enjoy the rest of your day. We're adjourned.